this evening. Now, please do open to John chapter 10. I better turn the mic on. You know, it's so funny, Ted. I'm telling you, I'm just out of it here tonight. If you imagine that this is the clicker, you know, for the slides. I walked up to this podium. I must have spent 15 minutes getting all these slides and everything ready. And that remote control was laying right there. And then I hunted everywhere for it, and I could not find it. I went down below, and I looked on the shelves. I went back in the box. I looked twice in here where it's supposed to be. I could not find that thing. Finally, I called Nolan. Nolan, help me. Do you know where that thing might be? He walks up here, and he goes, well, it's right there. So now we know truly how valuable Nolan is. Without him, we can't have this assembly here tonight. I hope I don't do any more of these this evening. So, we'll be in John 10 in just a minute. I did want to take just a moment, though, to show you a couple of slides right here. It's apparent, but you don't learn it till the end of the material we'll be looking at in John chapter 10, that Jesus is somewhere inside the city when these events are taking place. And particularly, we want to take note of a portico of Solomon. And so as you look at the city right here, this, of course, is a photo that's taken from the Mount of Olives. And you note how the Kidron Valley runs between, but you're on an elevation that looks down onto the Temple Mount. To the north, which is this area out over here, you can't see in the photograph, you're also looking down on the Temple Mount. And you can see the whole western hill here as well, which looks down onto the Temple Mount. And while there are valleys on all sides of this, the Temple Mount itself, the city is looking at the Temple Mount, which is well defended when somebody ever tried to attack it because of these valleys. But the Temple Mount stands on its own little mount of an island that's right in the middle of the whole city of Jerusalem. So everybody is really always able to see this Temple Mount. Now, the Dome of the Rock, the Muslim structure from the 600s AD, so now 1400 years old, of course, is on the location of the old temple itself, Solomon's Temple, which rebuilt by Herod or remodeled after the Ezra and Nehemiah had rebuilt it. Jesus is on this mount. He's working with these people in that immediate area. And inside that red square there, we're just going to zoom in on the same picture. But I wanted to show you a couple of more features of the immediate environment and the mount itself. So first, this little building right here is where I stayed for a week in 2017. So I lived in downtown Old City Jerusalem right there. That is exactly a quarter of a mile from my window, which was facing that golden dome. And so from dead center of the dome to that window is just a quarter of a mile. Over here on the hill, this is the hill. This is Golgotha. This is where Jesus was crucified. In the 300s AD, Constantine's mother, in her 80s, travels from Istanbul, imagine 300 AD, to come and explore Jerusalem. Her faith, misguided though it may have been, in incipient Catholicism, you know, moved her to want to see these areas. And so, starting in the 300s, right here in this region, a succession of Catholic church buildings, which you see these two domes represent the latest one, were placed here. Now, we suspect that she was probably pretty right, that likely right in that immediate area. And if, from where I was staying, it's a quarter of a mile, it's only two-tenths of a mile, so a little bit of a shorter distance even, from the location of Golgotha to where the temple stood. Which is to say that as Jesus is teaching in all this environment, if he's teaching on the Mount of Olives, if he's teaching on the north end of the city, if he's teaching anywhere in the western part of the city, if he's teaching anywhere on the Temple Mount, all he has to do is lift up his eyes, and what does he see? Where he knows he's going. That cross is going to be on that hill. Jesus cannot escape. Everywhere he goes in the city, this is where I'm headed. This is where I will give my life in sacrifice for those people who will love me, in sacrifice for my sheep, we're about to learn. this area now that I've highlighted is the eastern wall of the Temple Mount itself, upon which, long since torn down by the Romans and never rebuilt to its glory again, upon that is what is called Solomon's portico. Here's an artist's conception of what that may have looked like in Jesus' time. That structure, according to Josephus, who saw it with his own eyes and wrote about it, was made out of white marble. It is 23 feet wide and 40 feet tall. So, in this view, you kind of can't tell, you know, but it's open air between all of these columns and then 40 feet high. So, rain or snow, you'd still have a dry pavement area upon which, if you were to really pack people in a crowd shoulder to shoulder, it's 500 feet long. You could put about 10,000 people into that structure. Typically, of course, you'd have something less than that, but you could easily collect 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 people and preach to them year-round in this location. And all you would have to do, standing in here, is to go between any two of these pillars, and as you look out, what do you see? You see the temple itself, which is immediately west of this wall. And depending where you are on the 500-foot stretch, Jesus is able to look up and see where he will give his life as the Good Shepherd. So what we're going to do now is to come over to John chapter 9, verse 33, to begin this discussion, because I've made a special effort with both the miracles on Sunday morning and the parables now on Sunday evenings to try and scan well before and well after any given miracle or any given parable to see the greater lessons that are learned, the greater impact that reverberates out into all this environment, into this city, into all of these people. Now, very often, of course, we are familiar with the parable itself. We remember the message, and that's the purpose of a parable. It's a memory, you know, trick or help. Well, look who's here. Good to see the Cantwells. That's so funny. I was just thinking the other day, I hadn't seen you in a long time. I've gotten so used to seeing you guys. I haven't seen you in a long time now. Okay, so we're going to start at 9:33, which, you know, if you're like me at least, you never attach to chapter 10. We get a chapter heading. Truly, truly, it starts with, you know, here we go, you know, with this Good Shepherd information. And so that's where we always start. But really, brethren, it's very apparent. The entire 10th chapter is based on the entire 9th chapter. Now, the 9th chapter is given over to the healing of this blind man. We're not going to be reading all of that. We've talked about it, you know, in our miracles class anyway. But starting now at 9:33, we come to the tail end of this long chapter and all of its events. They answered and said to him, "You were born," excuse me, 33, "if this man were not from God, he could do nothing," says the blind man. That's his conclusion. They answered and said to him, "You were born entirely in sin, and are you teaching us?" And they put him out. It doesn't mean they ask him to leave the room. The fear of his parents and this man is that they would be put out of the synagogue. They lost their membership in the Jewish community and their right to worship God under the old law in their synagogue system of the day, because the man got his sight back. Jesus worked a miracle on him, and it's going to cost him dearly in his associations, you know, with the people about him. So in 34, they declare him to be entirely in sin. They're outraged that he would deign to teach them something. They put him out, which is a rejection not just of him, but of Jesus. So let me step back even farther and pick up a thread without reading the entire chapter. Look at verse 16 in chapter 9, 16. Some of the Pharisees were saying, "This man is not from God because he does not keep the Sabbath." Well, he healed on the Sabbath. But others were saying, "How can a man who is a sinner perform such signs?" And there was a division among them. In studying miracles, we see the impact of those miracles. They always point at the divine messenger and his message. And here, yet again, the people are divided. But the Pharisees, they're real sure he's not from God. Skip to 18. The Jews, therefore, did not believe it of him, that he had been blind and had received sight, until they called the parents of the very one who had received his sight. Well, they didn't believe them either. But the point is, if they don't believe him and they don't believe the parents, what they don't believe is Jesus. They don't believe that a miracle is taking place. Look at 22. His parents said this because they were afraid of the Jews. For the Jews had already agreed that if anyone should confess him to be Christ, he should be put out of the synagogue. Their minds are made up. All of these religious leaders, the power brokers, and the religion of the Jews at this time. And it's not in favor of the Lord. 24. A second time they called the man who had been blind and said to him, "Give glory to God. We know that this man is a sinner." They're referencing Jesus. Skip to 28. They reviled him and said, "You're his disciple, but we are disciples of Moses. We know that God has spoken to Moses, but as for this man, we don't know where he's from." So what have we been told over and over and over again as we go through the healing of the blind man throughout the entirety of the 9th chapter? Where do the Pharisees stand? They are utterly opposed to him. They have declared him to be a sinner. They have declared him to be a lawbreaker because he heals on the Sabbath. So, 34, "You're born entirely in sins." They put him out. And in 35, Jesus heard that they'd put him out. And finding him, he said, "Do you believe in the Son of Man?" He answered and said, "And who is he, Lord, that I may believe in him?" Jesus said to him, "You have both seen him, and he is the one who's talking with you." And he said, "Lord, I believe." And he worshiped him. And Jesus said, "For judgment I came into this world, that those who do not see may see, and that those who see may become blind." Is he now talking about physical sight and physical blindness? He not at all, is he? The conclusion, when all is said and done, and all the interviews and the you know arguments and decision making is going on in opposition of these Pharisees, the conclusion at the end, Jesus says, "I came to the world for judgment, that those who do not see may see, those who see may become blind." In other words, my miracles, as evidenced in the physical cure, are here to test people and to encourage people, but also to disqualify people, to identify those who can see with their hearts and their minds, who can see with their spiritual eyes, that if I can do these things, then I am a divine representative, at least a prophet. Certainly the better conclusion is Son of the Living God, Messiah the Christ. This is why I came. Look at the Pharisees now at verse 40. "Those of the Pharisees who were with him heard these things and said to him, 'We're not blind too, are we?'" They're looking right at him. They know he's not talking about physical sight. They suspect he might be saying they are spiritually blind, that they are ignorant and therefore blind, that they don't understand the law or what the evidence is that's right in front of them. "You're not talking about us, are you?" Jesus said to them, "If you were blind, you would have no sin. But since you say, 'We see,' your sin remains." Now, it's an interesting way that he's using by springboarding off the whole of the 9th chapter in the working of this miracle, switching up on him then about spiritual blindness. And now he says, "Precisely because you say, 'We see, we understand, and you're a sinner, and you're breaking the Sabbath, you're a lawbreaker, we're Moses' disciples, we want nothing to do with you.'" He says, "That's right. It's because you declare all those things that sure enough, you're blind. Now watch this and pretend nobody ever put a chapter break in. Start with 40. "Those of the Pharisees who were with him heard these things and said to him, 'We're not blind too, are we?' Jesus said to them, 'If you were blind, you'd have no sin. But since you say, 'We see,' your sin remains. Truly, truly, I say to you, he who does not enter by the door into the fold of the sheep, but climbs up some other way, he's a thief and a robber. But he who enters by the door is a shepherd of the sheep. To him, the doorkeeper opens, the sheep hear his voice, he calls his own sheep by name and leads them out. When he puts forth all his own, he goes before them. The sheep follow him because they know his voice. And a stranger they simply will not follow, but will flee from him because they do not know the voice of strangers. This figure of speech Jesus spoke to, now you tell me, to whom? It says them. Who's the them? It's the Pharisees who just thrown out this man from the synagogue because he'd been healed and spoke the simple truth. Though I was blind, now I see. We got a song to that effect. And so, this is all he's done. And the Pharisees threw out, verse 16, 18, 22, 24, 28, 29, 34, and 40 are all denying Jesus. So this is chapter 10. Is Jesus here on the Temple Mount in the portico? He's talking then at the heart of what these Pharisees control. He has healed the blind man. They've rejected him outright. And when he starts talking about gates and doors and sheepfolds and shepherds and good ones and bad ones and thieves and robbers, who's he pointing at the whole time? You Pharisees is who I'm talking about. It's not just this general information about Jesus. There's a lot of general information about Jesus. But what is it very pointedly? You guys are thieves and robbers trying to come up some other way. I am the door. I am the good shepherd. And Jesus is going to then preach this all the way down through verse 18. He's going to be giving these illustrations all the way down through verse 18. All because he is attacking the Pharisees for their failure to see what is right before their eyes. That's the context of John chapter 10. Now, I'll add one more thing before we get back, you know, and take a closer look at just this parable, I'll call it. But look at verse 6. I guess by classic definition, this is not a parable at all. It would be a simile, but not a parable. Still, it's called in verse 6 a figure of speech. So I decided that I'll go ahead and put it in this group. But you know, a parable is a story that you cast alongside. There was a sower that went out to sow. There was a king, you know, that did this. It's really not the classic form of a parable. But it's declared to be a figure of speech. It is an illustration. So while Jesus is just declaring these facts, is Jesus a door? Well, not in a physical sense. Is Jesus a shepherd? Well, not in a physical sense. But he is these things. When you see what he does for his God and for God's people. So truly, truly, I say to you, he who does not enter by the door into the fold of the sheep, but climbs up some other way, is a thief and a robber. Now, brethren, we've got thieves and robbers all about us. We've had thieves and robbers all everywhere, you know, for 2,000 years. Every counterfeit or substitute religion out there is run by thieves and robbers. They may be thieves and robbers quite consciously. An awful lot of them, you know, get caught and go to jail and all this kind of stuff because, you know, they're outright hypocrites. They're just in it for the money and the influence and whatnot. Others, just purely in ignorance. They're blind. But when the blind lead the blind, who falls in the ditch? The scripture says they both do. Okay? So, they're blind, they're still wrong, and they still suffer the consequences. There's no excuse for this blindness. But verse 2, he who enters by the door is a shepherd of the sheep. In other words, he comes in properly, which is what Jesus is doing in fulfilling prophecy. To him, verse 3, the doorkeeper, the great guard into this secure area where you keep the sheep overnight so that the wolves can't get in, bears can't attack. To him, the doorkeeper opens and the sheep hears his voice. He calls his own sheep by name. He leads them out, puts them forth, and he goes before them and they follow him because they know his voice. And a stranger they simply will not follow. they'll flee from him because they do not know the voice of the strangers. This is the figure of speech. The figure of speech is, I, Jesus, throughout the entire ninth chapter, was a good shepherd. I was doing everything God said to do, coming in through the door quite legally and properly. And every step of the way, you Pharisees have opposed me. You thieves, you robbers, trying to snatch these sheep, trying to rob the shepherd of his own. You are who I'm talking about. And I am your great nemesis and enemy, because everyone who has a heart to serve God, they're going to hear my voice, and they are going to run from you, Pharisees. They will not recognize your voice. They will not follow you. And that great division between all the argument that's going on in these various camps of the people who say, you know what, nobody can do worse like these except that God is with you. And those like the Pharisees that stick with the Pharisees, this is what Jesus is doing, is cleaving these people into those two camps with all the information that he teaches as well as the miracles that he worked. So number one, we have the figure of speech, if you want to make a note in your side margin, in verses 1 through 5, 6 declares it to be a figure of speech. Now let's talk about the door in verses 7 through 10. Jesus therefore said to them again, truly, truly, I say to you, I am the door of the sheep. All who came before me are thieves and robbers, but the sheep did not hear them. I am the door. If anyone enters through me, he shall be saved and shall go in and out and find pasture. The thief comes only to steal and to kill and destroy. I came that they might have life and might have it abundantly. Brethren, this parable or figure of speech, so famous in John chapter 10, is one of these great moments in which Jesus just smacks the face of these men, throws down that gauntlet, and just challenges them. Thieves, robbers, these are harsh words. They're pretty pointed. It is Jesus saying, I'm not taking any of this from you guys, and nor will any of my people, anybody that follows you, is being misled, is being stolen from the truth. So I'm the door. These thieves and robbers, they're here to steal, kill, and destroy. I came to give you life and more abundantly. You and I, as we come to this room tonight, we're a part of the sheep of this flock that Jesus is both a door and a shepherd for, as we're about to see. And the life that we have is the most abundant life you can live on this earth. No one else is so blessed. No one else has so much information to help them make their decisions. No one else can have such confidence in the decisions that they make and the life that they lead. Because we can read in this book that God in heaven, who created us, said we're to live like this. Jesus has become our shepherd. He feeds us. He leads us from pasture to pasture. He protects us at night. He's the shepherd. He's the door. He is our everything. This is one abundant life that you and I are living. Hence, our need to get out and tell other people about it and to help them to want to share in what is the most confident, joyful, satisfying life that can be offered to a human being. We come then to the Good Shepherd illustration, more specifically in verses 11 through 15. So if you want to mark out the next section, verses 11 through 15. I am the Good Shepherd. The Good Shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. He who is a hireling and not a shepherd, who is not the owner of the sheep, beholds the wolf coming and leaves the sheep and flees. And the wolf snatches them and scatters them. He flees because he's a hireling and is not concerned about the sheep. I am the good shepherd, and I know my own, and my own know me, even as the Father knows me, and I know the Father, and I lay down my life for the sheep. And the whole time Jesus is saying this, all he's got to do, turn to his left or his right and look west. And right past the side of the temple, what will he see? The place where he will lay down his life. That's where the shepherd's going. And it's not even a quarter of a mile away. You can see it from the Temple Mount. This is really a poignant moment in the life of Jesus. It's a powerful and enlightening moment where he says, I'm the good shepherd, and I'll lay down my life for these people. Now remember the portico. Here's all these people. And he is saying, I stand before you Pharisees, you thieves, you liars, you robbers. And you're going to have to come through me to get to these people who are my sheep. This is really a challenge. So we look at it typically by just dropping out of the sky, my favorite expression, you know, landing it, you know, in chapter 10, and we see this general kind of information. But if you haven't remembered chapter 9, you are missing the challenge. You are missing the heat of the moment. You are missing this great conflict. Pharisees are looking at him. You're not calling us blind, are you? You bet I am. What a moment this is. They're less than a quarter of a mile away from where he will prove that he's the good shepherd. And not too long from now. Let's move on to the sacrifice itself in verse 16, where he introduces the Gentiles. I have other sheep which are not of this fold. I must bring them also. They shall hear my voice. They shall become one flock with one shepherd. Now, brethren, that's pretty obscure for those people at that time. You and I know he's talking about the Gentiles. Some of them might be able to figure it out. Well, the only sheep, you know, are Jews. And if he's got some other flock and they're not Jews, what's left? Everybody else on the planet. It's got to be the Gentiles. Well, some of them might have picked it up. Some, you know, maybe too early. But you and I know. So with 16, if you want to make a note, you know, that's the Gentiles, no matter what your friendly neighborhood Jehovah's Witness might say. And then in verses 17 and 18, for this reason the Father loves me, because I lay down my life that I may take it again. No one has taken it away from me, but I lay it down on my own initiative. I have authority to lay it down. I have authority to take it up again. This commandment I received from my Father. So what did we read in the chapter 9 in 16, 18, 22, 24, 28, 29, 34, and 40? They'd already made up their minds that what? They're already counseling together that what? That he's going to go from here to there. He's going to walk that quarter mile. And he's going to die on a cross on that hill. Because what he is saying to these Pharisees in this figure of speech right now. So he is the good shepherd. He'll lay it down. Therefore, 19, now he's done speaking, you see the results. There arose a division among the Jews because of his words. Many were saying he has a demon and is insane. Why do you listen to him? Others are saying these are not the sayings of one demon possessed. A demon cannot open the eyes of the blind, can he? At that time, the feast of the dedication took place at Jerusalem. It was winter, and Jesus was walking in the temple in the portico of Solomon. That's why I gave you the artist's illustration earlier. So it's winter time. It's going to be cold. It may be raining. It may be snowy. Jerusalem's quite beautiful, as most cities are, you know, in the snow. But the whole time, brethren, he is right there, looking past the temple that will fall, not one stone left on another 4 years from now, at the hill of Golgotha. That's where your shepherd went. That's where my shepherd went. That's where he hung on that cross. That's where every one of these words he proved were real and true. And the thieves and the robbers have been active ever since. They were active then. It's our job to oppose them as effectively as Jesus did. Now we're going to do a similar thing now and look at another. I have no idea why that happened. What does that mean? Okay, Ted. Nolan, would you come up and fix this, please? I don't know what that is. I've never seen it before. Something just went wrong. I've got two slides that are superimposed over each other, and it's locked up. It won't go any farther. We'll have to do something about the next song. You're going to have to get out of your songbook probably because it isn't stuck.
But if you kind of look back here, what I was trying to show is the kingdom of Herod Agrippa, and it's all of this light green that you see clear down into here. And I was trying to point out what's about to take place in Luke 17, please turn to Luke, is in Perea. So here's Jerusalem. It's 14 miles to Jericho. It may be that much farther again that Jesus has walked across the plain of Moab, crossed the Jordan River, gone up into the hills of modern Jordan, and is in this region called Perea. From 41 to 44 A.D., this man who had all this greenish area now, as you can see with great difficulty, Herod Agrippa I, also was given Judea, which is this purple area right here, and he's going to rule the whole thing. Come Acts chapter 12, he's going to die a gruesome death by worm. Okay, this is the man, Herod Agrippa. Now, we're going to go over to John chapter 17. I'm sorry I can't get slides to work. It's not working with the keyboard, so I'm sure it won't work with the remote either. But let's go over to John 17. I'm going to start there at verse 7, as I recall. Okay. This is really very similar to John 10 in the sense that it's not a classic parable. But both of these occur in the same chronological region. They're the next things that come up chronologically. So I'm using both of them, as a figure of speech, but, not your real true, this is the way it works kind of thing parable. Verse 7. Which of you, so this is personal, these are guys, that have these circumstances themselves. Having a slave, there was perhaps 50% of the entire population of the Roman Empire were slaves at this time. Could have been that high. So it's everywhere. Which of you, having a slave plowing or tending sheep, will say to him when he has come in from the field, come immediately, sit down to eat? But will he not say to him, prepare something for me to eat, and clothe yourself, that is, dress up for the service, serve me until I have eaten and drunk. Afterward, you will eat and drink. He does not thank the slave because he did the things which were commanded, does he? So you too, when you do all the things which are commanded you, say, we are unworthy slaves. We've done only that which we ought to have done. When all you've done is your job, does anybody, deserve any great accolade, all kinds of kudos and all, for just doing what you're supposed to do? It's just average and standard. Wow. Imagine what this means. Each of you who next week will finally, after a lifetime of serious effort, come to the point in your life where you will never sin again. There will be no mistake in your life. No doctrinal error. Never misspeak. Next week, I'm sure for all of us, we're going to get right to the pinnacle of Christian success. We will never commit another sin. We will do all the work in the vineyard God wants us to do. And what credit, what big, let's rent a hall and sing their praises kind of an event do we deserve? You're just doing what you were supposed to be doing for how long? However old you are now, plus next week. You've only gotten to the place where you were supposed to have been all this time. Wow. But yeah, I get it. I'm sheep. My shepherd loves me. And he'll sacrifice his life for me, they're thinking. We know he did. How I need to get busy. How I need to uproot every evil thing in my life. How I need to acquire every virtue that's ever been named in Scripture. How we need to bind ourselves together into a congregation that is truly a light to the world and not just Tandy Turn. Got to blow the lid off the building, brethren, because we love the shepherd who protected us from the thieves and the robbers. Appreciate your attention as always. Please do stand and grab a songbook, because no matter how I try, I have not been able to get this thing to work. So we're not going to have the slides for the last one.
As you stand, please, James will come forward to lead us in song. Always, of course, we offer the invitation. If you're one who is ready to become a Christian, then come forward, speak with me while we're singing. If you need prayer, request, Bible study, whatever, by all means do so. And I can't see, what's that next song going to be?
504.
504.